14. The Law of Attributes. For every attribute, there is an opposite, effective attribute. In Chapter 6, The Law of Exclusivity, we made the point that you can't own the same word or position that your competitor owns. You must find your own word to own. You must seek out another attribute. Too often, a company attempts to emulate the leader. They must know what works, goes the rationale. So let's do something similar. Not good thinking. It's much better to search for an opposite attribute that will allow you to play off against the leader. The key word here is opposite. Similar won't do. Coca-Cola was the original and thus the choice of older people. Pepsi successfully positioned itself as the choice of the younger generation. Since Crest owned cavities, other toothpastes avoided cavities and jumped on other attributes like taste, whitening, breath protection, and more recently, baking soda. Marketing is a battle of ideas. So if you are to succeed, you must have an idea or attribute of your own to focus your efforts around. Without one, you would better have a low price. A very low price. Some say all attributes are not created equal. Some attributes are more important to customers than others. You must try and own the most important attribute. Cavity prevention is the most important attribute in toothpaste. It's the one to own. But the law of exclusivity points to the simple truth that once an attribute is successfully taken by your competition, it's gone. You must move on to a lesser attribute and live with a smaller share of the category. Your job is to seize a different attribute, dramatize the value of your attribute, and thus increase your share. For many years, IBM dominated the world of computers with its attributes of big and powerful. Companies that tried to move in on those attributes had little success. RCA, GE, Univac, Burroughs, Honeywell, NCR, and Control Data lost a lot of money on mainframe computers. Then an upstart from Boston went for the attribute of small, and the mini computer was born. They probably laughed in Armonk because they knew corporate America wanted big and powerful. Today, small has grown to such proportions that IBM's vast mainframe empire is in serious trouble. A company that never laughs at new attributes that are exactly the opposite of their current products is Gillette, the world's number one razor blade maker. Its dominance revolves around its high-technology razors and cartridge systems. When an upstart from France brought an opposite attribute to the category in the form of a disposable razor, Gillette could have laughed and wheeled out its research on how America wants hefty, expensive, high-technology razors. But it didn't. Instead, Gillette jumped in with a disposable razor of its own, called Good News. By spending heavily, Gillette was able to win the battle of the disposables. Today, the Gillette Good News razor dominates the disposable category, which has grown to dominate the razor blade business. Moral? You can't predict the size of a new attribute share, so never laugh. Burger King was unsuccessful when it tried to take the attribute fast from McDonald's. What should Burger King have done? Use the opposite attribute? The exact opposite attribute, slow, won't do for a fast food place, although there is an element of slowness in Burger King's broiling concept. A single trip to any McDonald's should be enough to find another attribute that McDonald's owns, kids. This is indeed the place to which kids drag their parents, and McDonald's has the swing sets to prove it. This sets up an opportunity vividly demonstrated by the Coke and Pepsi battle. If McDonald's owns kids, then Burger King has the opportunity to position itself for the older crowd, which includes any kid who doesn't want to be perceived as a kid. That generally works out to be everyone over the age of 10. Not a bad market. To make the concept work, Burger King would have to invoke the law of sacrifice and give all the little kids to McDonald's. While this might mean getting rid of a few swing sets, it also allows Burger King to hang Kiddyland on McDonald's. Chapter 9, The Law of the Opposite. To drive the concept into prospects' minds, Burger King would need a term. It could be grow up. Grow up to the flame-broiled taste of Burger King. The new concept for Burger King would strike fear and terror in the boardroom at McDonald's, always a good sign of an effective program. 15. The Law of Candor. When you admit a negative, the prospect will give you a positive. It goes against corporate and human nature to admit a problem. For years, the power of positive thinking has been drummed into us. Think positive has been the subject of endless books and articles. So it may come as a surprise to you that one of the most effective ways to get into a prospect's mind is to first admit a negative and then twist it into a positive. Avis is only number 2 in rent-a-cars. With a name like Smucker's, it has to be good. The 1970 VW will stay ugly longer. Joy, the most expensive perfume in the world. What's going on here? Why does a dose of honesty work so well in the marketing process? First and foremost, candor is very disarming. Every negative statement you make about yourself is instantly accepted as truth. Positive statements, on the other hand, are looked at as dubious at best, especially in an advertisement. You have to prove a positive statement to the prospect's satisfaction. No proof is needed for a negative statement. The 1970 VW will stay ugly longer. A car that ugly must be reliable, thinks the prospect. Joy, the most expensive perfume in the world. If people are willing to pay $375 an ounce, it must be a sensational perfume. With a name like Smucker's, it has to be good. Most companies, especially family companies, would never make fun of their own name. Yet the Smucker family did, which is one reason why Smucker's is the number one brand of jams and jellies. If your name is bad, you have two choices. Change the name or make fun of it. The one thing you can't do is to ignore a bad name, which is one reason why you won't find beer brands like Gablinger's, Grolsch, and Griesedick in your supermarket today. Avis is only number 2 in rent-a-cars. So why go with them? They must try harder. Everybody knew that Avis was second in rent-a-cars. So why go with the obvious? Marketing is often a search for the obvious. Since you can't change a mind once it's made up, your marketing efforts have to be devoted to using ideas and concepts already installed in the brain. You have to use your marketing programs to rub it in. No program did this as brilliantly as the Avis No. 2 program. Positive thinking has been highly overrated. The explosive growth of communications in our society has made people defensive and cautious about companies trying to sell them anything. Admitting a problem is something that very few companies do. When a company starts a message by admitting a problem, people tend to, almost instinctively, open their minds. Think about the times that someone came to you with a problem and how quickly you got involved and wanted to help. Now think about people starting off a conversation about some wonderful things they are doing. You probably were a lot less interested. Now, with that mind open, you're in a position to drive in the positive, which is your selling idea. Some years ago, Scope entered the mouthwash market with a good-tasting mouthwash, thus exploiting Listerine's truly terrible taste. What should Listerine do? It certainly couldn't tell people that Listerine's taste wasn't all that bad. That would raise a red flag that would reinforce a negative perception. Things could get worse. Instead, Listerine brilliantly invoked the law of candor. The taste you hate twice a day. Not only did the company admit the product tasted bad, it admitted that people actually hated it. Now that's honesty. This set up the selling idea that Listerine kills a lot of germs. The prospect figured that anything that tastes like disinfectant must indeed be a germ killer. A crisis passed with the help of a heavy dose of candor. As another example, General Foods admitted that grape nut cereal was a learned pleasure and advised consumers to try it for a week. Sales went up 23%. One final note, the law of candor must be used carefully and with great skill. First, your negative must be widely perceived as a negative. It has to trigger an instant agreement with your prospect's mind. If the negative doesn't register quickly, your prospect will be confused and will wonder, "What's this all about?" Next, you have to shift quickly to the positive. The purpose of candor isn't to apologize. The purpose of candor is to set up a benefit that will convince your prospect. This law only proves the old maxim, honesty is the best policy. 16. The law of singularity. In each situation, only one move will produce substantial results. Many marketing people see success as the sum total of a lot of small efforts beautifully executed. They think they can pick and choose from a number of different strategies and still be successful as long as they put enough effort into the program. If they work for the leader in the category, they fritter away their resources on a number of different programs. They seem to think that the best way to grow is the puppy approach. Get into everything. If they're not with the leader, they often end up trying to do the same as the leader, but a little better. It's like Saddam Hussein saying that all we have to do is fight a little harder and everything will work out. Trying harder is not the secret of marketing success. Whether you try hard or try easy, the differences are marginal. Furthermore, the bigger the company, the more the law of averages wipes out any real advantage of a trying harder approach. History teaches that the only thing that works in marketing is the single bold stroke. Furthermore, in any given situation, there is only one move that will produce substantial results. Successful generals study the battleground and look for that one bold stroke that is least expected by the enemy. Finding one is difficult. Finding more than one is usually impossible. Military strategist and author B.H. Liddell Hart calls this bold stroke the line of least expectation. The Allied invasion came at Normandy, a place whose tide and rocky shore the Germans felt would be an unlikely choice for a landing of any scale. So it is in marketing. Most often there is only one place where a competitor is vulnerable, and that place should be the focus of the entire invading force. The automobile industry is an interesting case in point. For years, the leader's main strength was in the middle of the line. With brands like Chevrolet, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, Buick, and Cadillac, General Motors easily beat back frontal assaults by Ford, Chrysler, and American Motors. The Edsel fiasco is a typical example. GM's dominance became legendary. What works in marketing is the same as what works in the military: the unexpected. Hannibal came over the Alps, a route deemed impossible to scale. Hitler came around the Maginot Line and sent his panzer divisions through the Ardennes, terrain the French generals thought impossible to traverse with tanks. As a matter of fact, he did it twice, once in the Battle of France and again in the Battle of the Bulge. In recent years, there have been only two strong moves made against GM. Both were flanking moves around the GM Maginot Line. The Japanese came at the low end with small cars like Toyota, Datsun, and Honda. The Germans came at the high end with super premium cars like Mercedes and BMW. With the success of Japanese and German flanking attacks, General Motors was under pressure to commit resources in an attempt to shore up the bottom and the top of its lines. Cadillacs were too cheap to block the high-priced German imports. In an effort to save money and maintain profits, GM made the fateful decision to build many of its mid-range cars using the same body style. Suddenly, no one could tell a Chevrolet from a Pontiac, or an Oldsmobile, or a Buick. They all looked alike. Its look-alike cars weakened General Motors in the middle, and opened up a move for Ford as it broke through with the European-styled Taurus and Sable. And then the Japanese jumped in with Acura, Lexus, and Infiniti. Now, General Motors is weak across the board. Look at Coke. At present, Coca-Cola is fighting a two-front battle with Classic and New Coke. While Coca-Cola Classic has regained a lot of its original strength, New Coke, an Edsel from Atlanta, is barely hanging on. We've seen endless slogans for Coca-Cola. We have a taste for you. The real choice. Catch the wave. Red, white, and you. You can't beat the feeling. And now, you can't beat the real thing. Nothing has moved the needle very much. The folks at Coca-Cola keep trying. They've even hired a Hollywood talent agent to contribute creative ideas. Any day now, the new shooters will parade into an Atlanta conference room and paper the wall with a new set of slogans. Top Coke management will then sit around and discuss the latest batch of creative moves. While it's theoretically possible to stumble across the right idea if you haphazardly generate all the ideas you can possibly think of, it's not an efficient way to work. Coke needs to make progress beyond just buying business. As we see it, Coke has only one two-part move to make. One part is a step backward, the other is a step forward. First of all, Coke has to bite the bullet and drop New Coke. Not because it's a loser or an embarrassment, but because the existence of New Coke blocks the company from effectively using the only weapon it has. With New Coke safely tucked away in the archives, Coke would be able to invoke the law of focus and bring back the concept of the real thing and use it against Pepsi. To pull the trigger, Coke could go on television and say to the Pepsi generation, "All right, kids, we're not going to push you. When you're ready for the real thing, we've got it for you." That would be the beginning of the end of the Pepsi generation, if Pepsi Cola hasn't already killed it off all by itself. Not only is this idea simple and powerful, but it's really the only move available to Coke. It exploits the only words that Coke owns in the minds of its prospects, the real thing. To find that singular idea or concept, marketing managers have to know what's happening in the marketplace. They have to be down at the front, in the mud of the battle. They have to know what's working and what isn't. They have to be involved. Because of the high cost of mistakes, management can't afford to delegate important marketing decisions. That's what happened at General Motors. When the financial people took over, the marketing programs collapsed. Their interest was in the numbers, not the brands. The irony is that the numbers went south, along with the brands. It's hard to find that single move if you're hanging around headquarters and not involved in the process. 17. The Law of Unpredictability. Unless you write your competitors' plans, you can't predict the future. Implicit in most marketing plans is an assumption about the future. Yet marketing plans based on what will happen in the future are usually wrong. With hundreds of computers and an army of meteorologists, no one can predict the weather 3 days in advance. So how do you expect to predict your market 3 years in advance? IBM developed a massive marketing plan to hook up all PCs to its mainframes. The company called it Office Vision. Yet the plan is dead in the water thanks to developments at Sun Microsystems, Microsoft, and other companies. You might say that Office Vision foresaw everything but the competition. Failure to forecast competitive reaction is a major reason for marketing failures. When Pickett was asked which Confederate leader was responsible for the defeat at Gettysburg, he replied, "I've always thought the Yankees had something to do with it." Yet there are those who would say that America's big problem is the lack of the long view, that American management is too short-term in its thinking. Won't eliminating long-term plans make things even worse? On the surface, those concerns are real. But it's important to understand what is meant by long-term versus short-term. Most of corporate America's problems are not related to short-term marketing thinking. The problem is short-term financial thinking. Most companies live from quarterly report to quarterly report. That's a recipe for problems. Companies that live by the numbers die by the numbers. Harold Janine of ITT fame is one man in recent times who best exemplifies this approach. He would wheel and deal and beat up his managers for ever-increasing earnings. Janine's efforts resulted in a house of cards that eventually fell apart. Today, ITT is a shell of what it once was. Good accounting, bad marketing. General Motors was doing fine until the financial folks took over and put the focus on the numbers instead of the brands. They allowed Alfred P. Sloan's plan of differentiated brands to fall apart. Every division head, in order to make their short-term numbers, started to chase the middle of the market. Good short-term planning is coming up with that angle or word that differentiates your product or company. Then you set up a coherent long-term marketing direction that builds a program to maximize that idea or angle. It's not a long-term plan, it's a long-term direction. Tom Monahan's short-term angle at Domino's Pizza was to come up with that home delivery idea and build a system that delivered pizzas quickly and efficiently. His long-term direction was to build the first nationwide home delivery chain as rapidly as possible. Monahan couldn't own the words home delivery until he had enough franchisees to afford national advertising. He accomplished both objectives, and today, Domino's is a $2.65 billion company with a 40% share of the home delivery business. Monahan did it all without a complex 10-year plan. So what can you do? How can you best cope with unpredictability? While you can't predict the future, you can get a handle on trends, which is a good way to take advantage of change. One example of a trend is America's growing orientation toward good health. This trend has opened the door for a number of new products, especially healthier foods. The recent runaway success of Healthy Choice frozen entrees is a clear example of a product that took advantage of this long-term trend. ConAgra introduced Healthy Choice in March 1989. Years earlier, however, there were plenty of low-sodium, low-fat, light brands on the market, but these healthy ideas were buried under line extension names. ConAgra was the first to use a simple name and concept to take advantage of a trend that has been going on for years. Unfortunately, ConAgra is well on its way to confusing things with a wide array of Healthy Choice line extensions that go way beyond entrees. It is violating the law of sacrifice. The danger in working with trends is extrapolation. Many companies jump to conclusions about how far a trend will go. If you believe the prognosticators of a few years ago, everyone today is eating broiled fish or mesquite barbecued chicken. Hamburger sales are doing just fine, thank you. Equally as bad as extrapolating a trend is the common practice of assuming the future will be a replay of the present. When you assume that nothing will change, you are predicting the future just as surely as when you assume that something will change. Remember Peter's law. The unexpected always happens. While tracking trends can be a useful tool in dealing with the unpredictable future, market research can be more of a problem than a help. Research does best at measuring the past. New ideas and concepts are almost impossible to measure. No one has a frame of reference. People don't know what they will do until they face an actual decision. The classic example is the research conducted before Xerox introduced the plain paper copier. What came back was the conclusion that no one would pay 5 cents for a plain paper copy when they could get a Thermofax copy for a cent and a half. Xerox ignored the research, and the rest is history. One way to cope with an unpredictable world is to build an enormous amount of flexibility into your organization. As change comes sweeping through your category, you have to be willing to change and change quickly if you are to survive in the long term. Yesterday, General Motors was slow to react to the small car trend. It has cost the company dearly. Today, IBM is slow to acknowledge the trend away from mainframes. It could cost the company dearly. At present, the workstation is a real threat to both mainframes and mini computers. It offers enormous power at very low cost. If IBM is going to protect its computer leadership, the company must become a serious player in a category dominated by Sun Microsystems and Hewlett-Packard. A natural move would be to introduce a new generic. IBM's best opportunity might be to name its new line of high-powered workstations PMs, just as it did with its very successful PCs. PM could stand for Personal Mainframe. These two generic words dramatically capture the speed and power of these new desktop machines. They are also words that IBM owns in the mind. The combination would be very powerful. The only problem with a concept like this probably lies inside IBM itself. The term personal mainframe would strike terror in IBM's mainframe division, as well as in its personal computer division. We suggest that the phones would ring, and the case would quickly be made that a personal mainframe would undermine these two important sources of income. It's probably true that a personal mainframe product would undermine IBM's two other main sources of revenue, but a company must be flexible enough to attack itself with a new idea. Change isn't easy, but it's the only way to cope with an unpredictable future. One final note that's worth mentioning: there's a difference between predicting the future and taking a chance on the future. Orville Redenbacher's Gourmet Popping Corn took a chance that people would pay twice as much for a high-end popcorn. Not a bad risk in today's affluent society. No one can predict the future with any degree of certainty, nor should marketing plans try to. 18. The Law of Success. Success often leads to arrogance, and arrogance to failure. Ego is the enemy of successful marketing. Objectivity is what's needed. When people become successful, they tend to become less objective. They often substitute their own judgment for what the market wants. Donald Trump and Robert Maxwell are two examples of people blinded by early success and untainted by humility. And when you're blind, it is indeed hard to focus. Mr. Trump's strategy was to put his name on everything, committing the cardinal sin of line extension. Denial seems to go hand in hand with a big ego. When we first met the Donald, his opening remarks were about how people accuse him of having a big ego. He went on to state that it was totally untrue. He did not have a big ego. All the while, it was hard to avoid noticing a 3-foot-high brass T sitting on the floor next to his desk. So much for the sermon. Success is often the fatal element behind the rash of line extensions. When a brand is successful, the company assumes the name is the primary reason for the brand's success, so they promptly look for other products to plaster the name on. Actually, it's the opposite. The name didn't make the brand famous, although a bad name might keep the brand from becoming famous. The brand got famous because you made the right marketing moves. In other words, the steps you took were in tune with the fundamental laws of marketing. You got into the mind first, you narrowed the focus, you preempted a powerful attribute. Your success puffs up your ego to such an extent that you put the famous name on other products. Result? Early success and long-term failure, as illustrated by the failure of Donald Trump. The more you identify with your brand or corporate name, the more likely you are to fall into the line extension trap. It can't be the name, you might be thinking, when things go wrong. We have a great name. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18. Tom Monahan of Domino's Pizza is one of the few executives who have recognized how ego can lead you astray. You start thinking you can do anything. I was that way back in the early days. I got into frozen pizzas for a while, and that was a disaster. If I hadn't messed around with those frozen pizzas for the better part of a year, trying to sell them in bars and restaurants, Domino's probably would have had a lot more stores by now. Actually, ego is helpful. It can be an effective driving force in building a business. What hurts is injecting your ego in the marketing process. Brilliant marketers have the ability to think like a prospect thinks. They put themselves in the shoes of their customers. They don't impose their own view of the world on the situation. Keep in mind that the world is all perception anyway, and the only thing that counts in marketing is the customer's perception. As their successes mounted, companies like General Motors, Sears Roebuck, and IBM became arrogant. They felt they could do anything they wanted to in the marketplace. Success leads to failure. Consider Digital Equipment Corporation, the company that brought us the mini computer. Starting from scratch, DEC became an enormously successful $14 billion company. DEC's founder is Kenneth Olson. His success made Ken such a believer in his own view of the computer world that he poo-pooed the personal computer, then open systems, and finally, reduced instruction set computing, RISC. In other words, Ken Olson ignored three of the biggest developments in the computer category. A trend is like the tide. You don't fight it. Today, Ken Olson is out. The bigger the company, the more likely it is that the chief executive has lost touch with the front lines. This might be the single most important factor limiting the growth of a corporation. All other factors favor size. Marketing is war, and the first principle of warfare is the principle of force. The larger army, the larger company, has the advantage. But the larger company gives up some of that advantage if it cannot keep itself focused on the marketing battle that takes place in the mind of the customer. The shootout at General Motors between Roger Smith and Ross Perot illustrates the point. When he was on the GM board, Ross Perot spent his weekends visiting dealers and buying cars. He was critical of Roger Smith for not doing the same. "We've got to nuke the GM system," Perot said. He advocated atom bombing the heated garages, chauffeur-driven limousines, executive dining rooms. Chauffeur-driven limousines for a company trying to sell cars? If you're a busy CEO, how do you gather objective information on what is really happening? How do you get around the propensity of middle management to tell you what they think you want to hear? How do you get the bad news as well as the good? One possibility is to go in disguise or unannounced. This is especially useful at the distributor or retailer level. In many ways, this is analogous to the king who dresses up as a commoner and mingles with his subjects. Reason? To get honest opinions of what's happening. Like kings, chief executives rarely get honest opinions from their ministers. There's too much intrigue going on at the court. Another aspect of the problem is the allocation of time. Quite often the CEO's time is taken up with too many United Way meetings, too many industry activities, too many outside board meetings, too many testimonial dinners. According to one survey, the average CEO spends 18 hours a week on outside activities. The next time waster is internal meetings. The average CEO spends 17 hours a week attending corporate meetings and 6 hours a week preparing for those meetings. Since the typical top executive works 61 hours a week, that leaves only 20 hours for everything else, including managing the operation and going down to the front. No wonder chief executives delegate the marketing function. That's a mistake. Marketing is too important to be turned over to an underling. If you delegate anything, you should delegate the chairmanship of the next fundraising drive. The Vice President of the United States, not the President, attends the state funerals. The next thing to cut back on are the meetings. Instead of talking things over, walk out and see for yourself. As Gorbachev told Reagan, it is better to see once than to hear 100 times. Small companies are mentally closer to the front than big companies. That might be one reason they grew more rapidly in the last decade. They haven't been tainted by the law of success. 19. The law of failure. Failure is to be expected and accepted. Too many companies try to fix things rather than drop things. Let's reorganize to save the situation is their way of life. Admitting a mistake and not doing anything about it is bad for your career. A better strategy is to recognize failure early and cut your losses. American Motor should have abandoned passenger cars and focused on Jeep. IBM should have dropped copiers, and Xerox should have dropped computers years before they finally recognized their mistakes. The Japanese seem to be able to admit a mistake early and then make the necessary changes. Their consensus management style tends to eliminate the ego. Since a large number of people have a small piece of a big decision, there is no stigma that can be considered career damaging. In other words, it's a lot easier to live with, "We were all wrong," than the devastating, "I was wrong." This egoless approach is a major factor in making the Japanese such relentless marketers. It's not that they don't make mistakes, but when they do, they admit them, fix them, and just keep coming. The hugely successful Walmart has another approach that enables the company to deal with failure. It's called Sam Walton's Ready, Fire, Aim approach. It's an outgrowth of his penchant for constant tinkering. Walton was well aware that nobody hits the target every time, but at Walmart, people aren't punished if their experiments fail. As Walmart's chief executive said in a Business Week article, "If you learn something and you're trying something, then you probably get credit for it. But woe to the person who makes the same mistake twice." Walmart is different from many large corporations because so far it appears to be free of an insidious disease called the personal agenda that can creep into any corporation. Marketing decisions are often made first with the decision maker's career in mind and second with the impact on the competition or the enemy in mind. There is a built-in conflict between the personal and the corporate agenda. This leads to a failure to take risks. It's hard to be first in a new category without sticking your neck out. When the senior executive has a high salary and a short time to retire, a bold move is highly unlikely. Even junior executives often make safe decisions so as not to disrupt their progress up the corporate ladder. Nobody has ever been fired for a bold move they didn't make. In some American companies, nothing gets done unless it benefits the personal agenda of someone in top management. This severely limits the potential marketing moves a company can make. An idea gets rejected not because it isn't fundamentally sound, but because no one in top management will personally benefit from its success. One way to diffuse the personal agenda factor is to bring it out in the open. 3M uses the champion system to publicly identify the person who will benefit from the success of a new product or venture. The successful introduction of 3M's Post-it notes illustrates how the concept works. Art Fry is the 3M scientist who championed the Post-it notes product, which took almost a dozen years to bring to market. While the 3M system works, in theory, the ideal environment would allow managers to judge a concept on its merits, not on whom the concept would benefit. If a company is going to operate in an ideal way, it will take teamwork, esprit de corps, and a self-sacrificing leader. One immediately thinks of Patton and his Third Army and its dash across France. No army in history took as much territory and as many prisoners in as short a period of time. Patton's reward? Eisenhower fired him. 20. The law of hype. The situation is often the opposite of the way it appears in the press. When IBM was successful, The company said very little. Now, it throws a lot of press conferences. When things are going well, a company doesn't need the hype. When you need the hype, it usually means you're in trouble. Young and inexperienced reporters and editors tend to be more impressed by what they read in other publications than by what they gather themselves. Once the hype starts, it often continues on and on. No soft drink has received more hype than New Coke. By one estimate, New Coke received more than $1 billion worth of free publicity. Add to that the hundreds of millions of dollars spent to launch the brand, and New Coke should have been the world's most successful product. It didn't happen. Less than 60 days after the launch, Coca-Cola was forced to come back with the original formula, now called Coca-Cola Classic. Today, Classic outsells New about 15 to 1. No newspaper has received more hype than USA Today. At its launch in 1982, where the President of the United States, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and the Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate. The residue of this initial hype was still so great that most people cannot believe USA Today is a loser. No computer has received more hype than the next computer. Demand for press conference credentials was so great that Steve Jobs had to print tickets in advance, even though the auditorium could hold several thousand people. All the seats were filled. Steve Jobs makes television news as well as the cover of many major publications. IBM, Ross Perot, and Canon have invested $130 million. Will Next be a winner? Of course not. Where is the opening? Next is the first in a new category of what? History is filled with marketing failures that were successful in the press. The Tucker 48, the U.S. Football League, Videotext, the automated factory, the personal helicopter, the manufactured home, the picture phone, polyester suits. The essence of the hype was not just that the new product was going to be successful. The essence of the hype was that existing products would now be obsolete. Polyester was going to make wool obsolete. Videotext was going to make newspapers obsolete. The personal helicopter was going to make the roads and highways obsolete. The Tucker 48, with its Cyclops Eye headlight, would revolutionize the way Detroit makes automobiles. Only 51 were ever built. In the heavily touted Office of the Future, everything was going to be integrated into one ball of computer wax. The last time we looked, there were separate typewriters, now called personal computers, separate laser printers, separate fax machines, separate copy machines, separate postal meters. The Office of the Future is aptly named, a concept that will remain forever in the future. These predictions violate the law of unpredictability. No one can predict the future, not even a sophisticated reporter for the Wall Street Journal. The only revolutions you can predict are the ones that have already started. Did anyone predict the overthrow of communism and the Soviet Union? Not really. It was only after the process had started that the press jumped on the crumbling communist empire story. Contrast the first Tucker with the first Toyopet that hit the shores of California. Did the Los Angeles Times do a story on how Japanese imports were going to shake up the auto industry? Not at all. The only stories that made the news were about the little cars from Japan that fell apart because they weren't up to the rigors of American roads. Toyopet, of course, went on to become a big winner after changing the cars and changing the car's name to Toyota. When MCI got started by launching a microwave service between Chicago and St. Louis, did the press say, "Watch out, AT&T, here comes the competition"? No, they pretty much ignored little MCI. When Sun Microsystems shipped its first workstation, did the press note the significance of the event? That someday workstations would rattle the cages at IBM and DEC? No, the press ignored Sun. Forget the front page. If you're looking for clues to the future, look at the back of the paper for those innocuous little stories. Neither the personal computer nor the facsimile machine took off like a rocket. The personal computer was introduced in 1974. It took 6 years for IBM to strike back with the PC. Even the PC didn't boom until a year and a half later, when Lotus 1-2-3 hit the market. Capturing the imagination of the public is not the same as revolutionizing a market. Take the picture phone, now called the video phone. Ever since its introduction at the 1964 New York World's Fair, the picture phone has been in the news, usually on the front page. The latest example is a front page story in the Wall Street Journal. The video phone era may finally be near, bringing big changes. This is the third try for AT&T. In the 70s, it failed with the picture phone at $100 a month. In the 80s, it failed with a picture phone meeting service at $2,300 an hour. In the 90s, AT&T is hustling $1,500 video phones. It's easy to see why the video phone hasn't made much progress. Who wants to get dressed up to make a phone call? What isn't so easy to see is why the video phone gets so much hype. There's a clue in the subhead of the journal article, "An Alternative to Travel." Look out, American Airlines, United, and Delta, your days are numbered. The hype really isn't about the video phone at all. It's about the coming revolution in the travel industry. Over the years, the greatest hype has been for those developments that promise to single-handedly change an entire industry, preferably one that's vital to the American economy. Remember the helicopter hype after World War II? Every garage would house a helicopter, making roads, bridges, and the entire automobile industry obsolete overnight. Did Donald Trump get a helicopter? Did you get yours? Donald actually did get his, but he had to give it back to the bank. Then there was the manufactured home hype. It was reported that the single most expensive product a family ever buys could be made on the assembly line, revolutionizing the construction industry. From time to time, no-frills food makes the headlines. It is reported that this development will revolutionize the packaged goods industry. Brands are out. People will read the labels and buy products on their merits rather than on the size of the brand's advertising budget. It's all hype. The latest overhyped development is that of the pen computer, which will revolutionize the personal computer field and make computers accessible to everyone, whether they can type or not. It's all hype. Not that there isn't a grain of truth in every overhyped story. Anyone with $580,000 plus tax can buy a little five-seat Bell helicopter. The pen computer might be attractive to a narrow segment of the market, especially the traveling salesperson crowd. The video phone could revolutionize the phone sex industry, and there's a substantial market for mobile homes and recreational vehicles, all manufactured on assembly lines. But, for the most part, hype is hype. Real revolutions don't arrive at high noon with marching bands and coverage on the 6 p.m. news. Real revolutions arrive unannounced in the middle of the night and kind of sneak up on you. 21. The Law of Acceleration. Successful programs are not built on fads, they're built on trends. A fad is a wave in the ocean, and a trend is the tide. A fad gets a lot of hype, and a trend gets very little. Like a wave, a fad is very visible, but it goes up and down in a big hurry. Like the tide, a trend is almost invisible, but it's very powerful over the long term. A fad is a short-term phenomenon that might be profitable, but a fad doesn't last long enough to do a company much good. Furthermore, a company often tends to gear up as if a fad were a trend. As a result, the company is often stuck with a lot of staff, expensive manufacturing facilities, and distribution networks. A fashion, on the other hand, is a fad that repeats itself. Examples: short skirts for women and double-breasted suits for men. Halley's Comet is a fashion because it comes back every 75 years or so. When the fad disappears, a company often goes into a deep financial shock. What happened to Atari is typical in this respect. And look how Coleco Industries handled the Cabbage Patch Kids. Those homely dolls hit the market in 1983 and started to take off. Coleco's strategy was to milk the kids for all they were worth. Hundreds of Cabbage Patch novelties flooded the toy stores. Pens, pencils, crayon box, games, clothing. 2 years later, Coleco racked up sales of $776 million and profits of $83 million. Then the bottom dropped out of the Cabbage Patch Kids. By 1988, Coleco went into Chapter 11. Coleco died, but the kids live on. Acquired by Hasbro in 1989, the Cabbage Patch Kids are now being handled conservatively. Today, they're doing quite well. Here's the paradox. If you were faced with a rapidly rising business with all the characteristics of a fad, the best thing you could do would be to dampen the fad. By dampening the fad, you stretch the fad out, and it becomes more like a trend. You see this in the toy business. Some owners of hot toys want to put their hot toy name on everything. The result is that it becomes an enormous fad that is bound to collapse. When everybody has a Ninja Turtle, nobody wants one anymore. The Ninja Turtle is a good example of a fad that collapses in a hurry because the owner of the concept got greedy. The owner fans the fad rather than dampening it. On the other hand, the Barbie doll is a trend. When Barbie was invented years ago, the doll was never heavily merchandised into other areas. As a result, the Barbie doll has become a long-term trend in the toy business. The most successful entertainers are the ones who control their appearances. They don't overextend themselves. They're not all over the place. They don't wear out their welcome. Elvis Presley's manager, Colonel Parker, made a deliberate attempt to restrict the number of appearances and records the King made. As a result, every time Elvis appeared, it was an event of enormous impact. Elvis himself contributed to this strategy by overdosing early and severely dampening his future appearances. Likewise, Marilyn Monroe and James Dean. Forget fads, and when they appear, try to dampen them. One way to maintain a long-term demand for your product is to never totally satisfy the demand. But the best, most profitable thing to ride in marketing is a long-term trend. 22. The Law of Resources. Without adequate funding, an idea won't get off the ground. If you have a good idea and you've picked up this audiobook with the thought in mind that all you need is a little marketing help, this chapter will throw cold water on that thought. Even the best idea in the world won't go very far without the money to get it off the ground. Inventors, entrepreneurs, and assorted idea generators seem to think that all their good ideas need is professional marketing help. Nothing could be further from the truth. Marketing is a game fought in the mind of the prospect. You need money to get into a mind. And you need money to stay in the mind once you get there. You'll get further with a mediocre idea and $1 million than with a great idea alone. Some entrepreneurs see advertising as the solution to the problem of getting into prospects' minds. Advertising is expensive. It cost $9,000 a minute to fight World War II. It cost $22,000 a minute to fight the Vietnam War. A one-minute commercial on the NFL Super Bowl will cost you $1.5 million. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak had a great idea, but it was Mike Markola's $91,000 that put Apple Computer on the map. For his money, Markola got one-third of Apple. He should have held out for half. Ideas without money are worthless. Well, not quite. But you have to use your idea to find the money, not the marketing help. The marketing can come later. Some entrepreneurs see publicity as a cheap way of getting into prospects' minds. Free advertising is how they see it. Publicity isn't free. Rule of thumb, 5, 10, 20. A small public relations agency will want $5,000 a month to promote your product, a medium-sized agency $10,000 a month, and a big-time agency $20,000 a month. Some entrepreneurs see venture capitalists as the solution to their money problems, but only a tiny percentage succeed in finding the funding they need this way. Some entrepreneurs see corporate America as ready, willing, and financially able to get their offspring off the ground. Good luck, You'll need it. Very few outside ideas are ever accepted by large companies. Your only real hope is finding a smaller company and persuading it of the merits of your idea. Remember, an idea without money is worthless. Be prepared to give away a lot for the funding. In marketing, the rich often get richer because they have the resources to drive their ideas into the mind. Their problem is separating the good ideas from the bad ones and avoiding spending money on too many products and too many programs. Chapter 5, The Law of Focus. Competition is fierce. The giant corporations put a lot of money behind their brands. Procter & Gamble and Philip Morris each spend more than $2 billion a year on advertising. General Motors spends $1.5 billion a year. Life can be unfair for the smaller marketer facing larger competitors. Consider A&M Pet Products, a small company in Houston, Texas. A&M invented clumping cat litter, one of the most important breakthroughs in the category. The concept is simple. When cats use the litter box, this new type of litter clumps the waste into balls, which are easily scooped out and disposed of. There is no need to replace the entire box. The brand, called Scoop-Away, took off wherever it was introduced. This quickly got the attention of Golden Cat Corporation, which has the number one cat litter brand, Tidy Cat. Recognizing a threatening idea when they see one, Golden Cat introduced their own version of clumping cat litter, called Tidy Scoop. Not only did they jump on A&M's idea, they also borrowed the scoop part of their brand name. How unfair can you be? The winner of this cat fight will probably be determined by money. Who has the most money to drive in the idea? Unlike a consumer product, a technical or business product has to raise less marketing money because the prospect list is shorter and media is less expensive. But there is still a need for adequate funding for a technical product to pay for brochures, sales presentations, and trade shows, as well as advertising. Here is the bottom line. First, get the idea, then go get the money to exploit it. Here are some shortcuts you could take. You can marry the money. Georgette Mosbacher married Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher in 1985. 3 years later, Ms. Mosbacher bought La Prairie, a Swiss cosmetics firm, for $31.5 million. Where did she get the money? From everyone. Venture capitalists, La Prairie distributors in Switzerland and Japan, plus her own and her husband's resources. In the first year under Georgette Mosbacher's control, La Prairie's sales were up 30%. Then she sold out at a hefty profit. You can divorce the money. Frances Lear arrived in New York in 1985 at the age of 61. Freshly divorced from her television producer husband Norman All in the Family Lear, she was determined to launch a magazine for women over 40. She was prepared to spend $25 million of her expected $112 million settlement on the project. By its fifth issue, Lear's magazine had 350,000 readers. You can find the money at home. Donald Trump would never have gotten anywhere without Dad's millions behind him. You can share your idea by franchising it. Tom Monahan was able to put Domino's Pizza on the map by pursuing an aggressive program of franchising his home delivery idea. So far, we've been talking about smaller companies and their fundraising strategies. What about a rich company? How should it approach the law of resources? The answer is simple. Spend enough. In war, the military always errs on the high side. Do you know how many rations were left after Operation Desert Storm? A lot. So it is in marketing. You can't save your way to success. The more successful marketers front-load their investment. In other words, they take no profit for 2 or 3 years as they plow all earnings back into marketing. Money makes the marketing world go round. If you want to be successful today, you'll have to find the money you need to spin those marketing wheels. Warning. We would be remiss if we did not warn our listeners about the potential dangers of trying to apply the laws of marketing within an existing organization. Many of these laws fly in the face of corporate ego, conventional wisdom, and the Malcolm Baldrige Awards. The law of perception runs counter to the corporate culture of most companies, where trying to be better is deeply ingrained. People are forever running around and benchmarking the leader in the category, and then setting out to beat their specs. It's what the quality movement is all about. The law of leadership is tough for many to swallow. Most people want to believe they got to the top by being better, not by being first. So beware. Management won't take kindly to any suggestions that will take the emphasis off their better product strategy. The law of sacrifice could cause you problems. Offering everything for everybody is deeply ingrained in most organizations. If you have any doubts, just stroll down the aisles of any supermarket. What you will find is variation upon variation of sizes, flavors, and forms. It boggles the mind. Why this happens is painfully obvious. Nobody wants to focus. Large companies have offices filled with young, bright marketing people. Do you expect them to just sit there and do nothing? They feel compelled to tinker and make improvements. After all, how can they make their mark on the organization? So beware. Those young, bright marketing people will not take kindly to any efforts to curtail their tinkering. The law of focus suggests owning a word in the prospect's minds. What word does your company own in the minds of your prospects?
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.